Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
You made it to Little Friday. We're getting close. You know, coming after a short week with the long weekend, this thing seems like 2 weeks in one, but I guess every week sort of does, right? It's the 9th of July. There are questions about whether we are back at war with Iran, and we may not be able to answer them today. But we're going to do our best with an update coming up from the White House. Becca Wasser is going to join us from London with the options that are now facing the president, who is back home. He's got a bunch of events on his schedule. None of them are open to the press, mostly things described as signing time and executive time. But if he does emerge, of course, we'll be talking about it with our eyes on the markets here. And we talked yesterday about whether this is the new normal, whether anything really changed at all. We're blowing up more stuff. Iran's shooting back a little more. But there's technically still a ceasefire, aside from the president saying it was over. There's been no formal dispatching of the MOU, and the markets are creeping higher again here. The price of oil is rolling back, and by the end of the day, we'll probably be talking about the reflecting pool or the Arc de Triomphe or something else that has nothing to do with what matters. And we'll all be surprised the next time this flares up. Then again, as I said, we blew up a lot of stuff last night. Second straight day of attacks, U.S. Central Command taking to Twitter, because that's the only way you communicate around here anymore. Another round of strikes to further degrade Tehran's ability to attack commercial shipping in the strait, which, by the way, may as well be frozen with a foot of ice because no one's going through it right now. Strange to see oil fall back. Then again, with the technical response to yesterday's big jump, I don't know, you figure that out. About 90 targets were hit, though, by the U.S., including air defense systems, coastal surveillance assets, missile and drone storage sites. U.S. forces remained vigilant, I read, lethal, and prepared to execute operations directed by the commander-in-chief. The IRGC has also been busy hitting bases in Kuwait and Bahrain. That's the way they do it, you know. They don't have much ability to strike us. They're not going to go shoot at an aircraft carrier, so they lob missiles over to our friends in places like Kuwait and Bahrain, where massive U.S. bases and ports are located. Saying in a post on X, Mohammed Ghalibaf, the parliamentary speaker, "Let me be clear, if you strike, you will be struck back." The president says, "We've already won." That was the message on Air Force One last evening when he went to the back of the jet to talk to reporters. Listen.
"We have many ways we can win. But we've already won militarily. They have very little. They have very little left. And they want to make a deal so badly. They called a little while ago. They want to make a deal so badly. I just don't know if they're worthy of making a deal. I don't know that they're going to honor the deal."
Now, that was the new Air Force One, right? I'm getting confused. They had to put them on the old Air Force One to get out of Turkey. Then I guess they met the old one met the new one in England, and he got back on the new jet. The one with the luxury and Corinthian leather, gifted by Qatar. Let's figure out what's going on by way of the White House. Then we're going to get analysis from Becca Wasser. Tyler Kendall is on the North Lawn right now, where the sun is threatening to come out. Tyler, it's great to see you. Welcome back. Have we heard from the president today about any of this? Do we know the status of the MOU?
At this point, Joe, President Trump was asked yesterday about whether or not these developments meant that we are going to see all-out fighting when it comes to the conflict in Iran. And he himself said, quote, "I don't know." So as his word is to what we are now reporting, we're going to have to watch to see how this develops, because it's become very evident that the White House's patience was wearing thin when it comes to the diplomatic efforts. President Trump himself has outlined that that doesn't necessarily mean that all diplomacy is off. He did seem to give some leeway yesterday for his negotiators to continue their work, though he said in his opinion he doesn't think that it will ultimately prove fruitful. And the fighting that we've seen in the last 48 hours does mark the most significant uptick since that memorandum of understanding was signed. But what really feels different about this time, I think it's fair to say, is that we saw the U.S. put back back on the economic pressure. We saw the U.S. earlier this week revoke that waiver to allow Iranian crude to get to market. Previously, when there's been flare-ups, those sanctions had been in place. But the fact that this was considered to be really that carrot rather than the stick to get Iran to the negotiating table, and the U.S. has already chosen to reverse that, that does seem like a very significant development beyond the kinetic action, because this was something that the White House was really willing to put out there, put on the table. But at this point, it didn't seem to budge Iran in the right direction.
It's interesting you point this out, Tyler. Iran has rushed out tankers carrying roughly 11 million barrels of crude the past 24 hours. We're reporting on the terminal here. The problem is it's on the water. They just can't get it out anywhere if the president's going to be blocking the strait. We'll have to follow this very closely. And Tyler, we thank you. I'm sure we'll have more to talk about in our second hour here as we go live from the North Lawn of the White House to our Bloomberg Bureau in London, where Becca Wasser is standing by. Our top defense analyst at Bloomberg Economics is with us as the president is once again presented with a menu of options. Becca, I'm really glad you could join us, and I'd love your thoughts on what's happening right now, how we find 90 targets two nights in a row of attacks when the president has said that we have already defeated them militarily. How do we keep finding new things to target?
Well, one is it's because targets are regenerating. We see Iran trying to rebuild its capabilities and shifting assets all around. That's going to generate new targets. But also, so much of this, it's really restrikes. You see this continued cycle where essentially the United States finds itself mowing the lawn, to steal an Israeli phrase, which is continually going after targets again and again to keep them from regenerating to a point where they can hold various assets at risk. And so this brings the U.S. into a really slippery slope where it's starting to look as though we're going to be in conflict for a very long time, and that potentially could risk being in one of the very forever wars that, frankly, Trump wanted to not even get into in the first place.
And here we are with the president saying we're hitting them 20 to 1. I don't know what you make of this. Listen to the rhetoric from the president last evening on the scale of this most recent round of attacks, Becca. Here he is.
We just hit them very hard. And I say we hit them 20 to 1. Every time they hit us, we're going to hit them 20. They did a little something today, but it was really retribution for last night. They hit actually three boats, not two. And when they hit, we hit back much harder.
They hit three boats, not two, he said. When they hit back, we hit back. 20 to 1 is his point, Becca. I don't know if that's a military strategy, but how different in scale and intensity are these attacks that we're pursuing these last 2 days based on what we've seen over the past couple of weeks?
Well, let's start with the math. I am no economist, but I'm pretty sure that 3 times 20 is 60, not 90. But that being said, I think we did see really a slight shift in some of the targets that the U.S. went after in this second day of strikes. And that is an expansion of the geography slightly, as well as purposely going after two railway bridges. So that's critical infrastructure that can be used for military purposes, but also civilian purposes. And I see that as a signal to Iran of, if you are going to continue these strikes, we have options to escalate. And one of the ways in which we can escalate is to go after some of the basic civilian infrastructure across your country. And that's going to also cause you some pain with your own domestic population.
Okay, I'll bite on the bridge, because Iran issued a statement about this, saying that this was a direct violation of the MOU. Others have said it smacked of war crimes when you start attacking civilian infrastructure. What really went on here, Becca?
I think there was an effort to try and, once again, degrade Iran's ability to be able to carry out attacks. And perhaps they were using these railways for logistics and trying to move material around. You know, but again, it's a very slippery slope here for the United States. If you go after civilian infrastructure, and they can argue that these are essentially dual use, things that can be used for military means as well as for civilian means, making them acceptable under international law. But it is a slippery slope, and particularly when you've had rhetoric from the president in the past where he's essentially said that he's going to annihilate an entire civilization in reference to Iran, you look at certain attacks on civilian infrastructure and you find yourself potentially in a place that is not necessarily the most palatable.
Becca, thank you so much, as always. Something tells me the London Bureau is getting smarter all the time. She leads our defense analysis at Bloomberg Economics. Becca Wasser, thanks to you. The statement from Iran's foreign ministry about the attack on the railway line and that bridge, a flagrant violation, the words chosen, of Articles 1 and 5 in the U.S.-Iran Memorandum of Understanding.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
As we wait to hear from the president today, and he could still open some of the events that he has on his schedule, billed so far simply as signing time and executive time, which we frequently see on the presidential guidance. We're also covering breaking news and a vacuum that has been left in the Senate race in Maine. Listen.
I have faced some very serious allegations, and I just want to make it clear. This is all false. We did it the way that we were told we are supposed to make change. And we won. And now they are not going to let us have it. Not if it's me. And so we're suspending campaign operations.
An emotional Graham Plattner in an 11-minute free-form handheld vertical video, seemingly recorded on his telephone, raging against the party machine, and making the announcement that many, if not most, Democrats in Maine were hoping for, suspending his race for U.S. Senate. This, of course, is not the end of the story. As we've heard repeatedly from organizers in the Democratic Party, the Plattner campaign was trying somehow to affect the outcome of, well, what happens next and who might replace him in carrying the Democratic torch in an effort to unseat Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine, frequently targeted by Democrats, never toppled. And there are questions this evening about how exactly this is going to go forward. The party is now talking about a nominating convention with only weeks to go. And we wonder if that will be enough for voters to feel like they had a say in this and to have a credible campaign move forward in such a short period of time. A lot easier said than done, as we now play to our political panel for their take on this. Bloomberg Politics contributors Jeannie Shanzano and Rick Davis join us now. I'm glad to say Jeannie is here, democracy visiting fellow at Harvard Kennedy School's Ash Center, and our friend Rick Davis, partner at Stonecourt Capital, our Republican strategist. Now what, Jeannie? How do you pull off a convention with 600 delegates with 2 weeks?
Yeah, and can I just say, Joe, he needed to say five words. I'm suspending my campaign. Instead, we were treated to this crying game, narcissistic, oh, blaming the media, blaming everybody, never taking responsibility for the very credible allegations against him of breaking and entering and rape, along with the many other things, including Nazi tattoos. That was a video for the ages, I have to say, and one we really didn't need. And, you know, I would just give credit to the Maine Democratic Party, the executive director there, Devin Murphy Anderson. She has done a brilliant job pushing back, particularly on something that you mentioned, which is the reason apparently this video took so long to come out, because this guy and his campaign wanted a role in his replacement. Now, can you just imagine if somebody like Eric Swalwell said, I'll step down from the governor's race in California, but I'd like to decide who's going to fill in? You know, it is narcissistic. And, you know, the Maine Democrats do have a process in place. It's a short time period, but boy, good riddance. And there's a big, rich Democratic bench there that can certainly fill and excel in these shoes.
Well, the crying game had a surprise ending, as I remember here, Jeannie, and this can, too. You know, if anybody could pull this off, I figure it's Rick Davis. What do you have? 2 weeks. So it's July 27. You need to hold a nominating convention this month, Rick. 600 delegates to pick the nominee. Go. How do you do it?
You know, actually, you know, getting a hall and filling it with people who are already leaders of the Democratic Party of Maine isn't the hard part. And even okay. picking a candidate, you know, that's just a couple of ballots. Boom, you got a candidate. The hard part starts then, which is getting the entire Democratic Party to embrace that individual, to get the money wrapped around that individual in order to wage a campaign that's going to be the most expensive campaign in the midterm elections. I mean, they're talking about a potential ad buy totaling $400 million. And if the candidate is incredible, the money doesn't show up, and really it doesn't matter whether or not you'd had a convention or not. So the trick here really starts post-convention. And it almost doesn't matter who they pick. I mean, the parties are going to have to coalesce around this individual, regardless of their barnacles or their abilities, and, you know, and make this a competitive race. Because as you know, as we heard from Jim Messina earlier today on this show, he's run every kind of rationale around this, how to win Democrats win the Senate. And the one thing he keeps getting back to is all roads lead through Maine. So this is the kind of thing where if the Democrats are prepared to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on a brand new candidate with limited statewide experience and probably a record of losing, that's what's going to make this critical for them.
Boy, really something. And yes to all of this. Jeannie, we heard from Emily's List, the pro-choice women's PAC, responded to that video post that Graham Plattner put on Twitter. 11 minutes, it says, and zero accountability. With that said, what do we need to hear from the Elizabeth Warrens and the Ro Khannas and the Bernie Sanders, who were okay with the Nazi tattoo, they were okay with the sexting and the philandering, whatever else all these other accusations were, but found a line here? Because a lot of this, as I think you have stated, could have been prevented.
It absolutely could have. And you know, Emily's List, I couldn't agree more. They are absolutely right. Zero accountability there. And I do think you have Democrats with eggs on their face. And I would say it starts with the DSCC. It starts, unfortunately, with the Democratic National Party with Chuck Schumer. You know, part of what we have to do is go back when Plattner was first plucked out of obscurity, and he was plucked by D.C. and New York City progressive consultants. He didn't grow up organically out of the Maine woods. He was plucked. And what they did is they wanted Janet Mills to run. She was uncertain. She was hemming and hawing. And they pushed out other really viable candidates, which is why we saw so many candidates get in on the governor's race there. And so they do have egg on their face. They're going to have to account for this. But I do think this is in some ways the best thing that could have happened, and the fact that it happened in time to replace him. And Joe, I have to say, one person we're not going to see on the ballot is McDreamy. Patrick Dempsey wrote an op-ed. He's not running, but he is going to look to see who the candidate's going to be. But there are a lot of viable candidates out there, and a lot of progressives who can, without all the baggage, who have the same issues on their side that Plattner was running on. He is not the only progressive out there.
Well, and some of whom have been vetted and were in the gubernatorial campaign. Nirav Shah is getting a lot of talk, former Maine CDC chief, as well as the state secretary of state, Shanna Bellows. We'll see about that, obviously. But these could be somewhat familiar names, certainly on the convention level. We'll see, I guess, on a statewide level. Rick, I want to dive back into this video that Graham Plattner made, because he said a lot in 11 minutes, and it got a little conspiratorial at times. You could sort of feel the cosmic irony that this man is sensing as he sits out there on the deck in Maine, steps from the oyster farm. Listen to how he put this sort of media, political party conspiracy together in what he sees as a war against him. Listen.
We live in a political system that is not built for normal people. It is a system that is built structurally to make sure that movements like ours cannot flourish. That if they begin to succeed, they can be crushed. But now the ball is in the court of the Democratic establishment. My name might be on the ballot right now, but that ballot line belongs to the people of Maine. And on November 3rd, it needs to belong to the people of Maine. And the next Democratic senator for Maine needs to belong to the people of Maine. They need to reflect the will and the values of the people of this state.
Now, beyond making you think that you don't want to be around this man when he's angry, Rick, a lot of people believe what he said. Even take Graham Plattner's name out of it and this campaign. Believe that about American politics. And as somebody who has taken so-called normal people, albeit many exceptional ones, as a campaign manager and molded them into a candidate and started a career in politics, I just wonder how you respond to that.
Yeah, look, this is the politics that we live in today, not the politics that I grew up in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. And you could close your eyes, and as David Axelrod said today, Graham Plattner took his script from Donald Trump. I mean, this is the same kind of rhetoric that Donald Trump used when he first ran for the Republican nomination, right? Oh, these Republicans, the establishment's against me. We're going to have to rip this out of their hands. And literally, if you'd close your eyes and change the voice, it just very well could have been the same person, not taking responsibility for any of their own shortfalls, not taking any responsibility for anything they'd done wrong in the process. And so, look, I mean, this is the script. And every time Democrats criticize Donald Trump for, you know, this kind of lack of accountability, all they got to do is look in the mirror and see Graham Plattner staring right back at him. And so until we have an agreement that somehow none of this actually is good for politics or good for the people who practice politics, then I think we're going to just see more of this kind of junk. I mean, the last thing we needed to do is have to watch that video, listen to him not take responsibility, and count how many cars went by while he was given that thing. The worst produced thing I've ever seen in my life. I would only
Who's directing this? Sirens,
you know, come pick him up.
Happens to the best of us.
Happens to the best of us.
Jeannie, he suspended his campaign. That used to be something that you did when you were thinking about dropping out of the race, which I thought the first video was. Remember, he was going to stop down and think about things. Now he's suspending the campaign. Everybody, including me, says, well, he's out of the race. Should we assume that? I mean, is he waiting for some sort of window to come back?
He can wait. The New York Times poll just before he dropped showed, this was before these allegations came out, showed that he was losing to Susan Collins. And I am going to just remind everybody that Republicans let Donald Trump become president and run three times on their ticket. And they have nominated Ken Paxton to be their senator from Texas. The difference is Democrats have pushed out Plattner. But the other thing, Joe, is I think we need to get over this moment where if you are working class, if you are somebody who has never run for office before, you have somehow committed these atrocities against women, you have made anti-Semitic statements, and we're supposed to look away. There are a lot of wonderfully successful, progressive, populist people out there who have not been accused of these kind of really credible and horrific crimes. So the idea we have to take one with the other is laughable. And that shows that these consultants who went there did not do their job, and the Democratic Party did not do its until now that they got him out.
Boy, really something. Just quickly, Rick, as a campaign operative, what happens to the folks who are running Graham Plattner's campaign, may have not shared information or were responsible for this dumpster fire that we have here? Do they get jobs in the next cycle? How does this work?
Yeah, first of all, on suspending the campaign, it's a legal framework. It allows him to continue to spend money and take it in to pay the bills that he owes. So that's just a nomenclature. Yeah, it's going to be very hard for these guys the way this went down. That video is going to basically tattoo unemployable on their forehead in politics.
Wow, jeez. All right, speaking of tattoos, pun intended, I'd say we put this one to bed. Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano will help us figure out, though, how we're going to get through this convention and figure out what this race is going to be. I feel like we need to get up to Maine, everybody. Producer James is going to set up the bandwagon. Maybe we'll be on the way. Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano, Bloomberg Politics contributors. Thank you on this day after Plattner suspends the campaign.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
It's the Thursday edition, and we're still following the bead in Iran. After another night of back and forth, this was the second straight night of attacks by the U.S., as promised by the president. And while we've not heard from Donald Trump today, U.S. Central Command on social media saying forces completed another round of strikes with 90 targets this time. Air defense systems, coastal surveillance assets, missile and drone storage sites. And saying that U.S. forces remain vigilant, lethal, and prepared suggests there may be more where this came from. The president has repeatedly been presented with military options, and we know that fire is coming back in the other direction, not necessarily at the U.S. armada that has been lined up near the strait. The IRGC struck U.S. bases in Kuwait and Bahrain, repeating a pattern that we have seen, striking our allies in the region that are home to U.S. assets. And we want to hear more about this and maybe get a better idea of where we stand, where this MOU is, where the ceasefire stands, with Emily Harding, Vice President of the Defense and Security Department at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, and a real expert as we watch her resume as former Director for Iran of the National Security Council, former Deputy Staff Director on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Emily, it's been a long time, and we're glad to have you back. Welcome to Bloomberg TV and radio. Are you assuming the ceasefire is over, or that we're simply continuing this pattern of tit for tats against the backdrop of some form of talks?
I don't think it's really over. I think this is definitely another example of war being a continuation of policy by other means. Basically, both sides are communicating with violence at the moment. What we see is the Iranians expressing their displeasure at several triggers that have happened recently, including Israeli strikes inside Lebanon, some clashes with the Kurds in the north of Iran, and then also this transit of ships close to the Omani side of the border. And we just saw them wrap up funeral festivities for the Ayatollah, and that's a moment where they seem to really have wanted to reassert themselves in the Strait. And then we see the Trump administration pushing back very hard with retaliatory strikes. So we are in one of these cycles, but that doesn't mean that we can't return to negotiations, return to a ceasefire when both sides have, in effect, said their piece.
Well, Emily, the U.S. attacked Iran's coastal southern provinces, and according to Iran, this is not from CENTCOM, two bridges in eastern provinces along the railway line to the city of Mashhad. Iran calling the attacks, this is a statement from the foreign ministry, I'm sure you've seen it, a flagrant violation of Articles 1 and 5 of the MOU. For starters, what are we doing dropping bridges here? That seems like an escalation. And what do you make of a flagrant violation? Does it still stand?
I think both sides could shoot some talking points back and forth on who's violating the MOU more, but that's really not a productive conversation at this point. On the point of the bridges, though, I think there's some conflicting opinions about that. From a military perspective, you could say that those bridges were very useful militarily to move things around inside Iran that are necessary to keep harassing the Strait. On the other hand, it's also civilian infrastructure, and civilians need to get around. So this is one of those things where inside the Department of War, there would have been a lot of debate. Inside CENTCOM, there would have been a lot of debate over whether these were legitimate military targets. We're also pretty deep into this conflict at this point, and while we started it with a huge target deck, those have kind of worn down a little bit. So now what we're looking for is smaller targets, small fast boats, and things that are really going to send a message. Mm-hmm. And to me, those strikes on bridges and infrastructure really says to the Iranians that, look, we can bring some serious pain to your administration, and we're going to be in this to win this.
Wow. I wonder, and I've asked a few people this, when you hear a couple nights in a row, hey, we just struck 90 more targets, we're taking the fight to Iran. Having heard repeatedly from the president that we have defeated Iran militarily, we've destroyed their air force and navy, how can we continue to find so many new targets? Are they rebuilding, reconstituting sites, or are these lower level, lower grade targets that might not have been prioritized earlier in the war?
Right. So there are big strategic targets like the facilities where they're working on nuclear weapons production, where they're working on nuclear enrichment. Yep. Those things have been thoroughly destroyed. When you look at smaller targets like these, however, it is pretty easy to rebuild some of it. A lot of what they're doing in the Strait is they're harassing shipping with small drones. Those are very easy to hide, very easy to produce, and very easy to move around the country. So those are going to be the kind of mobile targets they're looking for now. We've also seen them try to harass shipping in the Strait with small boats, small fast boats. Those can be hidden in any number of places all along the Iranian coast, and they can keep moving that material into position. So while we are continually knocking down a lot of these targets, some of them are going to come back on. Others are going to be like deeper into the target deck, or these things that we didn't strike before that now we're going to send a message by striking.
Got it. As I mentioned, you were director for Iran on the National Security Council, 07-08, so the George W. Bush administration. Emily, to what extent were you talking about this very issue, the extent to which you gamed out having to protect the Strait or maybe occupying Karg Island? Are the stories and targets you're reading about now familiar to you? I realize you can't describe classified information, but were these considerations that long ago?
Quite familiar. In a lot of ways, this is a war that we've been planning for, waiting for 20 years. Back when I was on the National Security Council, we were seeing the Iranian government go after our troops in Iraq in a very aggressive way. And so we were planning for a potential escalation that could lead to this kind of war. We did the war games, we did the planning, we did the op plans. This has been something that the Pentagon has been ready to do for a very long time. And granted, they've been updating those plans based on what would be the most legitimate targets, the most painful targets for the Iranian regime. But one of the features of all of those discussions was always, how are they going to try to close the Strait? Will they be able to shut down global shipping? What can we do about it if they do? This particular round of conflict, I was surprised by how little preparation there was for that eventuality that they were going to close the Strait. It just seemed like an obvious move that they were always going to try to make. And I think what has really surprised the world is just how little effort it really takes on the part of the Iranians to make it unpalatable for things like global shipping to move through that very narrow waterway.
This is fascinating. That's, of course, when the commander-in-chief was calling Iran part of the Axis of Evil. We all remember that speech. Emily, what do you make outside of maybe lack of planning for the Strait the rest of the way the military has selected targets and comported itself over the past couple of months? Is this similar to what your administration would have done in terms of approach?
Oh, I think so. I mean, it's really a tale of two policies. There's one policy, which is the military execution of the president's orders. And in so many ways, that has been amazingly, perfectly, wonderfully done. From rescuing the downed airman who was in Iran, to the very precise targeting, to minimizing civilian casualties whenever possible, to being able to find, fix, and finish very quickly with the help of some new technologies. A lot of that has been proving the way of American warfare works very well, very efficiently, and can be lethal when it needs to be. On the other hand, though, you have the overarching policy of the conflict. You know, what are we really trying to accomplish here? There are things that you can accomplish via military means, and there are things that you just can't. So early on in this year, what we saw was the Trump administration come out and say that they were looking for things like an end to violence against protesters. They were talking about things like regime change or a new regime in Iran. And then they kind of backed off that rhetoric. And I suspect it's because somebody explained to them that these objectives are very difficult to achieve through military means. Instead, we shifted to this framework where we were looking at nuclear and Navy, and those things you can accomplish.
Now he's calling it the denuclearization is the word we've been hearing from the president. Emily, really great to have you back. Don't be a stranger. Emily Harding, CSIS. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.